you over. Oh yeah. Listen to me.
Things gonna get a little bit salty.
We've continued to see our costs increase each week, which we expect will continue into the third and fourth quarters.
Walmart, the world's largest retailer, joins a chorus of companies that say tariffs are making prices go up.
Today is Thursday, August 21st, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summer. Scientists say that climate change has put hurricanes on steroids.
So it's unambiguous that over the last 40 years, hurricanes in the Atlantic have become more frequent, more intense.
But are accurate hurricane forecasts at risk after recent funding cuts?
Plus the microbes behind great-tasting chocolate.
And even years after someone loses an arm, why do their brains keep refusing to believe it?
I had a couple of falls, and then I was trying to put my arm out to stop myself from falling without realizing that it wasn't there.
New research on brain plasticity after the news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Janine Herbst. Israel's military is mobilizing tens of thousands of soldiers. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has ordered military officials to speed up preparations to take control of Gaza City. NPR's Daniel Estrin has more from Tel Aviv.
Israel's military says it's calling up 60,000 new reservist soldiers to report for duty beginning in September. That will bring the total number of mobilized reservists to 120,000. It's part of the military's plans to displace hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from Gaza City, encircle the city, and send soldiers to battle Hamas inside the city. It's one of the last major areas Israel has not yet taken over in Gaza. Israel considers it a Hamas stronghold. Israel is considering a ceasefire deal Hamas endorsed on Monday to release half of the hostages in Gaza. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
President Trump says he plans to ride along tonight with the police and National Guard forces. NPR's Franco Ordonez has more on Trump's latest show of his commitment to wiping out what he calls rampant crime and homelessness in Washington, D.C.
President Trump said in an interview on a conservative talk radio show, The Todd Starnes Show, that he plans to go on patrol with the D.C. police and National Guard forces in the nation's capital.
I'm going to be going out tonight, I think, with the police and with the military, of course. So we're going to do a job.
The White House did not have any immediate confirmation or comment on Trump's plans. Trump earlier this month invoked emergency powers to try and take control of the Metropolitan Police Department. He also deployed National Guard soldiers and sent hundreds of federal law enforcement officials into the city. Franco Ordonez, NPR News, the White House.
The California State House has passed a bill to redraw the state's congressional lines. It's a retaliatory plan, with Democrats eyeing a handful of currently Republican seats to offset the GOP's attempt to pick up more seats in Texas. The state Senate is expected to pass it. Once California's governor signs it, it can go before voters this November. From member station KQED, Guy Marzorati has more.
Democrats in California are hoping to flip five House districts held by Republicans to match the five seats GOP lawmakers in Texas are eyeing with their own redistricting plan. California's current district lines are drawn by a voter-created commission, so Democrats will need voter approval to pass the plan. For NPR News, I'm Guy Marzorati in San Jose.
And the Texas State Senate meets tonight to vote on the redistricting plan passed by that state house that's likely to give Republicans five more seats in the midterms. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Russia launched a massive drone and missile attack in western Ukraine overnight, slamming into an American electronics factory, causing extensive damage and leaving more than a dozen people injured. It's one of Russia's biggest airstrikes, with more than 570 drones and 40 missiles, injecting further uncertainty into the U.S.-led efforts to end the three-year-old war that Russia started. Ukrainian President Zelensky has condemned this latest attack and is urging stronger international pressure on Moscow, including tougher sanctions. Conservative evangelical Christian leader James Dobson has died. He was 89 years old. As NPR's Jason DeRose reports, he founded the influential media organization Focus on the Family.
James Dobson created Focus on the Family in 1977 and through its syndicated radio program helped bring the culture wars to the mainstream. Dobson's shows focused on opposing abortion rights and challenging sex education and evolution being taught in public schools. A particular area of emphasis was his opposition to LGBTQ plus rights, including same-sex marriage and adoptions by same-sex couples. In 2004, Dobson founded a lobbying organization called the Family Policy Institute. His father, grandfather, and great-grandfather were all ministers in the Church of the Nazarene, but James Dobson himself wasn't officially a minister. Rather, he trained as a psychologist. Jason DeRose, NPR News.
Wall Street lower by the closing bell, the Dow down 152 points, Nasdaq down 72. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sony Pictures Classics with East of Wall, a new film by Kate Beecroft that is a portrait of female cowgirls in the New West. A rancher copes with her family, her ranch, and providing for a group of teens. Now playing in theaters.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We need you to defend KAXE with your donations. Due to funding losses, these are uncertain times for our little station. There are many ways to preserve People Power Radio in northern Minnesota. Visit kaxe.org/give or call Heather at 218-326-1234. Now back to All Things Considered.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. And Walmart is the world's largest retailer. It is also the latest of many companies to acknowledge that tariffs are leading it to raise some prices because Walmart's costs are growing every week. NPR retail correspondent Alina Selyuk is here to catch us up. Hi, Alina.
Hello, hello.
What did we learn from Walmart today?
So Walmart says tariffs are increasing its costs, quote, each week. Walmart expects to phase those rising costs all through the rest of the year. And so far, it's been able to mitigate those costs, to repeat, so far. This is from Walmart's latest earnings report, which is one of many we had this week, including from giants Target, Home Depot, and Lowe's. And the general takeaway is that tariffs have not led to some major shakeup of how people shop or how stores run, again, for now.
And no major shakeup. What about a minor shakeup?
Yeah, yes. Actually, let me play you what we heard from Walmart CEO Doug McMillon.
We aren't seeing dramatic shifts. The way things have played out so far, the impact of tariffs has been gradual enough that any behavioral adjustments by the customer have been somewhat muted.
So to put that in context,
yes, please.
Walmart has acknowledged that it's had to raise some prices, but largely it's been trying to absorb any of the extra tariff costs. For example, for back-to-school shopping, Walmart says its top products were actually cheaper this year than last year. But for some things that are imported, the cost of tariffs trickles down, and we've seen some of that on electronics and furniture, for example. And McMillon says higher prices are having an effect, particularly on middle-income and lower-income shoppers. They sometimes switch what they're buying. Sometimes they simply skip that purchase. Plus, he pointed out this trend that started last year because of inflation, and it's still continuing, which is that Walmart is attracting more higher-income shoppers who are looking for deals.
Can you go back for a second? I'm helping my kids pack for back to college stuff, and The costs do not seem down. When it comes to, you said back-to-school shopping, Walmart is trying to eat the costs. How's it doing that? Are they just making smaller profits or what?
That's part of it. They take on some of those costs. They pressure suppliers to do the same. They switch out options on the shelves. But then there's this other thing retailers have been doing, which is stockpiling. And basically, the Trump administration delayed the big tariffs so many times that companies were able to order their foreign goods in advance, while imports were not as expensive.
Uh-huh.
For example, this week, TJX, which is the parent of TJ Maxx and Home Goods, that company said its inventory jumped by about 10% compared to last year because the company presumably tried to really get ahead and be well-stocked for months to come. But CEO of Walmart McMillon did say today that at some point, stockpiles run out. And now, to replenish imports, retailers have to pay those new tariffs. So some prices are starting to reflect that or will start to reflect that.
And how worried are retailers like Walmart and others? How worried are they about the reaction they're going to get from shoppers in their aisles when they see those. Sounds like they're coming. Higher prices.
I think they're worried, but they're playing it cool. You know, last quarter, Walmart did make a direct warning that Trump's tariffs would raise prices, and President Trump chewed out the company online, demanding that they eat the cost instead. So now we're seeing more technical wording around prices, like Home Depot talks about broad-based price increases not happening, though some individual items are getting pricier. On top of that political pressure, there's also a bit of tariff fatigue, I think. People spend so much of the year worrying about tariffs, rushing to shop or not shopping because of tariffs, that now many people seem to just kind of be shopping. Overall, sales at restaurants and stores are chugging along. Sales at Walmart and Home Depot are growing. Although I will mention that Home Depot CEO did say that the number one thing people still say is preventing them from doing major projects is worry about economic uncertainty.
NPR's Alina Selyuk, thank you.
Thank you.
Our next story starts with a bag of sour cream and onion potato chips, ripple cut, but there were no chips inside of the bag. There was, though, a red envelope with at least $100 bill and several 20s. A longtime aide of New York City Mayor Eric Adams, who was also affiliated with his reelection campaign, handed this bag to a journalist for the news outlet called The City. The reporter tried to give back this bag as soon as she discovered what was inside it. Failing that, The City was naturally first to report this incident. The reporter left holding the bag is Katie Honan, and she speaks to us now from City Hall. Hi, Katie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Katie, just start by briefly walking us through the events of that day. Who was this aide and what happened?
So Winnie Greco, who formerly was employed here at City Hall but remains close to the mayor, was involved in, up until yesterday, with his reelection campaign, worked with him when he was a Brooklyn Borough president. She was at his reelection campaign office opening. He's been opening all these campaign offices, mm-hmm. and I see her at every single event.
Sure.
And I chat with her because I've reported on her previously, and like any reporter will tell you, they want to talk to people.
Right.
I saw her at the start. I saw her at the end. She texted me to call her. We hadn't really texted previously. And when I called her, she told me to meet her across the street, where when we walked into a Whole Foods, she handed me the bag of chips, which were opened, and the top was crumbled. There were still some chips inside, but, mm-hmm. you know, I tried repeatedly to give it back to her. And then after three times, I just, you know, held on to the bag. We chatted. As we left, she brought the chips. She brought the chips up again. I said, I don't really want the chips. You can take the chips. She told me to have them. And then a few moments later, after we left, when I got to the top of the subway, I opened the bag up. And that's when I discovered the red envelope, which I recognized from Lunar New Year and other celebrations, although it's August, so
right.
it's not really timely. And I hoped it was information, but instead it was money.
Well, Katie, I know that you've said you've spoken to her before. You've seen her a bunch. Your news outlet has investigated her work. Do you have any idea of what she was trying to do by giving you this bag of chips with money inside of it?
I don't know, and I don't know what... looking for a long-term thing or a short-term thing, but it was obviously incredibly inappropriate for her to do, given my role. And, you know, she'd repeatedly said, even previously, that, oh, she wanted us to be friends and she would talk. And I think that was maybe her end goal, but it just put me in a rough spot, and it was unfortunate that she did that.
I'm going to read part of the statement from her attorney, Stephen Brill. He denied that this was nefarious, said that he assures, I'm quoting here, that Winnie's intent was purely innocent. In the Chinese culture, money is often given to others in a gesture of friendship and gratitude. He goes on to say that she's apologetic and embarrassed by any negative or impression or confusion that this may have caused. Katie, I wonder, have you heard from Mayor Adams' office, his representation, City Hall, anything about this incident?
So Todd Shapiro, who's his campaign spokesperson, commented to us last night and did say Mayor Adams had no involvement or knowledge of it, and that she's no longer involved in the campaign, in which she was working in a volunteer capacity. But the Adams administration, it comes at an inopportune time for him, because today one of his former top aides, truly someone so close to him he called a sister, was indicted four more times in four separate cases for things that include bribery and misusing her position within City
right.
Hall to help people who gave her money. So it really has been a bad 24 hours for him.
I don't want to ask you to speculate, but is there any reason to believe that all those investigations that you've just been talking about involving Eric Adams and her circle and the incident that it happened to you, any indication to, or any reason to believe that they might be related?
At this point, it's hard to tell. And there have been so many separate and loosely connected or strongly connected investigations into people who've worked for Eric Adams, the only thing tying them together is that they worked in the Adams administration. So I don't know what's involved and what's connected, but it all rests, excuse me, on our current mayor.
Last thing, in the few seconds we have left, have you or your newsroom heard anything else from any investigators about this incident?
I have not. We referred it to the Department of Investigation, which is the city agency. It's an independent body that does investigate city employees. It was our understanding that they were still investigating for things Winnie may or may not have done as a city employee. So that's the latest.
Katie Honan is a reporter for the city and co-host of the FAQ NYC podcast. She's literally all that in a bag of chips. Katie, thanks.
Thanks so much.
Last week, a song from the Netflix animated movie K-Pop Demon Hunters made it to the top of the pop charts. Well, there's more where that came from, because this week, that film's soundtrack has done something no soundtrack has accomplished in nearly 30 years. NPR's Stephen Thompson has our update.
K-pop Demon Hunters has generated one of the hottest soundtracks in years. Led by Golden, the track by the fictional K-pop girl group Huntrix that made it to number one last week. Golden dips to number two this week, but K-pop Demon Hunters has reached a rare milestone at the same time. It's just the third soundtrack in history to land three top 10 hits in the same week. The other soundtracks to do that? Waiting to Exhale from the 90s. All you gotta do is say, and Saturday Night Fever from the 70s. For K-pop Demon Hunters, the top 10 hits are by two fictional K-pop groups, Huntrix and their rivals in the Saja Boys, whose members possess a truly demonic ability to craft boy band earworms. This week, Your Idol lands at number 4. While Soda Pop jumps to number 10. You're my soda pop, my little soda pop. Of course, the streaming era has made it easier for a single album to land multiple singles in the top 10 simultaneously. But for soundtracks, it's a different story. Even recent blockbusters like Barbie, Encanto, and Wicked haven't done what K-pop Demon Hunters does this week. And it might not even be done hitting milestones. How It's Done by Huntrix is sitting at number 14, ready to make its move. Stephen Thompson, NPR Music.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on People Powered Radio, KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is your Daily Dose of Phenology, where John Latimer looks back at his nature notes from the state. Programming is supported in part by the Minnesota Department of Public Safety, reminding you that speeders will pay a price, maybe the ultimate price. Please slow down. Extra speed patrols now on Minnesota roads. Now for your daily dose of phonology.
On today's date, August 21st, in the year 2000, I hear a gray tree frog calling. It takes me a while to identify it. I'm thinking, what bird is that? Why am I hearing a bird calling right now? Fall is hardly the time for bird calls. There are a few, the eastern peewee, sometimes a red-eyed vireo, but very little else in the way of bird calls in the fall. And this persistent call kept tickling my ear and making me wonder, who the heck is doing all this singing? Well, it took a while, and then finally I realized that the song wasn't moving around. If it was a bird, it was cemented to one spot. And that tripped the trigger in my brain that said, wait a minute, that's not a bird at all. It's the gray tree frog. And something about the timing of the day, the number of hours of daylight, whatever, tripped a hormonal trigger within the gray tree frog and made it think that it was time to start calling for a suitor.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly, and it is time now for our Science News Roundup from Shortwave. That is NPR's science podcast. I am joined this week by Emily Kwong. Hi there.
Hi.
And Hannah Chen. Hey to you in our New York Bureau.
Hello, hello.
Y'all have brought us three science stories that caught your attention this week. Lay them on me.
All right. We have the microbes behind great-tasting chocolate.
How birds at sea defecate way more than scientists thought.
And the molecules that might be responsible for your daytime sleepiness.
I am here all day and every day for great-tasting chocolate. What do we got?
Fantastic. Okay, so published in the journal Nature Microbiology, this research focuses on cocoa beans.
Cocoa beans, which make chocolate, which grow on trees?
Yeah, they do. And depending on where you go, you kind of get different flavor profiles from those cocoa beans. So it could be fruity or floral or spicy. And a team led by scientists at the University of Nottingham wanted to figure out what was driving these different flavor profiles, specifically at the level of microbes.
The level of microbes. So very, very tiny microorganisms. How are microbes involved in how chocolate tastes?
Well, after farmers pick cocoa beans, they ferment them, kind of let them sit in boxes or bags for days on end.
They do this because this is what has been taught to them generations from their parents.
Research fellow David Gopalchin said it's during fermentation that these microbial communities emerge, and they give rise to all kinds of flavor compounds for the chocolate.
Never thought about this. Do we know which microbes produce the best tasting chocolate?
Well, Mary Louise, best is kind of subjective, but The researchers did sample the microbes from three different farms in Colombia. They genetically sequenced the DNA from these microbes, and then they built a computer model to see how those tiny organisms interacted. Then they went full Willy Wonka.
Basically, the team created a cocktail of these microbes to start performing fermentation directly on beans in the lab to create their own chocolate flavor compounds, and it worked. Professional tasters confirm that these beans, fermented with a synthetic microbial community, exhibited flavor notes similar to fine chocolate.
Really?
I'm skeptical. What did they taste like?
David said it was really fruity, kind of bright and berry flavored.
So I'm thinking through the implications. More chocolate, that I'm pro more chocolate. But if scientists can just recreate chocolate flavors in a lab, what does that mean for the poor cocoa bean and for small-time chocolate farmers?
Yeah, I mean, it could be disruptive, but one thing to know about the state of chocolate right now is that there's a worldwide cocoa shortage due to climate change. Maybe the science could lead to fermentation starters that can make the process more predictable.
Wow. Okay, on a considerably more disgusting note, let's move on. Story number two, the bathroom habits of seabirds. Why? Who wants to study this and why?
It was kind of an accident. So a postdoc from the University of Tokyo, Leo Uesaka, was actually looking at the legs of these seabirds, which are called streaked shearwaters. He was studying how the birds take off from the water, and to do that, he'd strap cameras to their bellies facing backwards towards their behinds, and that's when he noticed something that really caught his interest.
Which was that they almost always took off to poop, and they were doing it way more and way more regularly than he thought they would. So Leo started a whole new research project to investigate.
And what did he find out?
Well, he ended up combing through more than 30 hours of bird bathroom tape, which he describes as
mentally difficult.
Yeah. Oh, go science. Such a labor of love.
That's what we chant to ourselves every day in the mirror.
Yeah.
And Leo found that while at sea, these birds defecate an average of every 4 to 10 minutes. And that didn't change based on their eating habits. They were going that often. And after doing some calculations, Leo concluded that birds lost 5% of their body mass every hour.
Every hour?
From defecating.
I mean, I guess if you're going every 4 minutes, I buy that. But I'm trying to figure out still that we have all seen birds go to the bathroom. We've all seen that they do this frequently. Is this really groundbreaking?
Well, a lot of estimates for how much seabirds excrete is based on land observations, but Leo's cameras and the research that he published in Current Biology gave both him and us a rare look at the bird's behavior at sea.
At sea? And why is that important?
Well, one reason is that feces or guano is important for how nutrients cycle in environments. Independent biologist Daniel Plaza studies how ecosystems function, and he says that fishing regulations, catch limits, they can be based on researchers' estimations of how much fish the birds need to eat to survive.
If we are underestimating how much poop they are doing, and it probably is connecting with how much food they are taking, we also underestimate how much food they need.
So basically, if birds are eating way more than previously thought, we'd need to reduce fishing further to give the seabirds more opportunities to catch the fish that they need to survive.
Moving right on.
Our last story, we are tackling the causes of daytime sleepiness. I'm going to refresh my coffee and chug some caffeine while we work our way through this one. But daytime sleepiness, excessive daytime sleepiness, is this common?
Apparently, yes. Excessive daytime sleepiness, EDS, happens when people fall asleep repeatedly during the day. This condition affects up to 1 in 3 people in the U.S., it's very common. And while it's often linked to sleep deprivation or other circadian disorders, EDS can still happen to people who are getting a full night's sleep. Plus, it's correlated with a higher risk of things like cardiovascular disease or hypertension.
1 in 3 people, you said. Hannah, yeah. How do we find out if we're among them?
Well, there's this survey called the Epworth Sleepiness Scale that's designed to measure daytime sleepiness. It basically gives you a list of activities, anything from reading a book to watching TV to riding in a car, and then it asks, how likely are you to doze off during each of these activities?
And I'm going to guess that if you have a high likelihood of dozing off during multiple things like watching TV, riding in a car, you're going to score higher on the sleepiness scale?
Yes. Researchers gave this survey to 6,000 volunteers, and then they collected their blood samples to see if there were any molecules in the volunteers' blood that were associated with higher or lower self-reported daytime sleepiness.
I just talked to Tariq Faqih. He was a lead author of this study, which just published Tuesday in the journal eBiomedicine. And that study focused in on metabolites, these little molecules that can come from things like diet or medication.
The most popular one I think people know is cholesterol. It's one of many, of thousands of metabolites in our bodies. There's so many of them.
Altogether, Tariq and his team looked at 877 different metabolites, and then they found 10 that seemed to be linked, either positively or negatively, to people's self-reported sleepiness.
Notably, a metabolite of tyramine, which is found in fermented foods, aged cheese, and alcohol, was associated with higher rates of self-reported daytime sleepiness, particularly in men.
And on the other hand, they found that omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids, which you find in foods like fish or vegetable oils or nuts and seeds, were associated with lower rates of reported sleepiness.
So what does this mean for me? Let's bring it back to what
Great
we should
question.
Be eating. Sounds like more fish, less old cheese and alcohol if we want to stay awake.
Your charcuterie board is doomed.
So it's really too early to tell. Tariq wants to do a clinical trial next, giving people different types of diets, maybe richer in certain metabolites and not others, to kind of see how they affect people's daytime sleepiness.
So we'll come back to you and let you know when the food to sleepiness science is a little more clear.
I will look forward to it. Emily Kwong and Hannah Chin from NPR science podcast Shortwave, which you can follow on your podcasting platform of choice for new discoveries and everyday mysteries and all the science behind the headlines. Thanks to you both.
Thank you, Mary
Louise. Thank you so much.
This is NPR News.
And I give up forever to touch you.
The Goo Goo Dolls' Iris was a hit in 1998. Now the band is back with more music. The EP is called Summer Anthem, the same name of their sold-out tour.
I just felt like at my age, it's like you better find something to say.
What does frontman John Resnick have to say? Find out tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News. And I-
It is 4:29, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is National Native News. KXE will be at the Minnesota State Fair tomorrow at the Ampers booth in the Education Building. Stop by and see Kari Headland and Malachi Coons. We receive support from the Move It Real Estate Group, assisting clients with real estate purchases and sales for over 25 years, not only in Grand Rapids, but across northern Minnesota. Move to what moves you. More at moveitrealestate.com. Tickets are now on sale for Hadestown, now through August 25th at the Mask and Rose Women's Theater in Popaski. The musical follows intertwined love stories from Greek mythology in a stylized underworld. Tickets are only available in advance at McKenzie Place in Bemidji. And weather tonight, thunderstorms during the evening with gusty winds and possible hail, clearing after midnight to partly cloudy skies, low 60 to 66.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. California's only Native American state lawmaker is calling on the University of California to return Native American remains and cultural items still in its possession, despite federal and state laws requiring repatriation. Christina Onnested reports.
California lawmakers condemned the University of California campuses that have failed to return thousands of Native American remains and hundreds of thousands of indigenous artifacts in their possession 35 years after federal law required their return to tribal communities. A new audit in April found UC campuses of Berkeley, Riverside, San Diego, and Santa Barbara have failed to comply and fully utilize funding allotted to them to help rematriate the remains. Here's Assemblyman Jeff Gonzalez.
If my grandmother was found, I would expect her remains to be given to her family. Not in 1 year, not in 35 years, but immediately.
The audit recommends specific funding and conditions on that funding to force compliance. UC Provost Catherine Newman says they're investing more money, but part of the challenge is finding experts to assist.
It's actually not easy to find those folks. There are some very technical requirements.
We're the qualified people.
Lee Sisko, tribal member of the Santa Rosa Rancheria Tachi Yukot tribe.
We're the expert in this field because those are our ancestors.
He spoke with California Assemblyman James Ramos of the Serrana Cahuilla tribe, who says repatriation will help Native Americans heal from the state's historical wrongs.
Those remains do carry connections to our people, and it's not until they're properly reburied that healing could start to take place from a traumatic experience that our people suffered from the history of the state of California.
Christina Onnested, California National Native News.
Earlier this week, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals blocked a land swap that would hand a swath of the Tonto National Forest, a parcel sacred to Native Americans, over to a multinational mining company. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, President Trump has weighed in.
On Truth Social, Trump blamed a radical left court for delaying the swap, which would clear the way for a massive mine run by Resolution Copper.
Trump is blatantly attempting to strong arm the court.
Adelita Grijalva says his rhetoric is reckless, dangerous, and even corrupt. She's running to fill the seat of her father, the late Arizona Congressman Raul, who spent his political career trying to stop mining in the area known as Oak Flat. Trump called those who oppose the mine anti-American.
Trump can try to shame us. We're not going to be silenced. For him to call us all anti-American for standing up to protect Oak Flat, it's not just wrong, it's offensive. Standing up for our communities, our land, and our future is the most American thing that we can do. And we're going to continue to do that.
Resolution Copper is owned by foreign mining giants Rio Tinto and BHP.
It's no surprise to see this president side with foreign corporations over America's natural resources and less for having any kind of consideration of tribal leaders in land.
San Carlos Apache Chairman Terry Rambler believes Trump has been misinformed by Resolution Copper's supporters, even offering to sit down with the president and share, quote, factual information to protect American assets. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
The Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians in Michigan announced a donation of $200,000 to support RX Kids in the Eastern Upper Peninsula. The program provides cash to moms and babies, which helps cover costs of necessities, including baby supplies, food, utilities, and rent. According to RX Kids, the investment reflects the tribe's commitment to maternal and child health and to uplifting families across the region. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Drummond Woodsum, a full-service law firm whose nationally recognized tribal nations practice provides services to tribal nations and their enterprises and to companies that do business with tribes across the country. More at dwmlaw.com.
Support comes from AirTalk Wireless, where individuals who qualify for the Tribal Lifeline program receive an iPhone or Samsung device, unlimited data, calls and texts, and international calling. Learn more at airtalkwireless.com/NNN.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
/great. UKG, our purpose is people.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. 20 years ago, Hurricane Katrina stunned the country. Since then, scientists have gotten a lot better at forecasting hurricanes and understanding how climate change influences them. But those scientists now fear that progress is in danger. NPR's Alejandra Barunda is here to explain. Hi, Alejandra.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so just big picture here. How has hurricane science evolved since Katrina?
I'll let Gabe Becky tell you. He's a climate and hurricane scientist at Princeton.
It's been a great 20 years. It's been a pivotal 20 years.
That's because right after Katrina, scientists from agencies like NOAA and universities and national labs all got together to work on something called the Hurricane Forecasting Improvement Project, or HFIP. And the project aimed to slash forecast error for both hurricane track, which is where a storm is going, and intensity by about 50% within 10 years. And it absolutely crushed those goals.
Crushed. How did they crush those goals?
Yeah. So they did two big things. First, scientists needed to build better computer models of the storms. And then they also needed better real observations of the storms. Because the best model in the world isn't super useful if you don't feed it good starting information. And HFIP and other federal efforts helped with both. HFIP was mostly on the modeling side, and other agencies helped improve the observations. Like NOAA and the Department of Defense launched these special satellites in the 2010s, and hurricane scientist Jeff Masters explains them.
These use microwaves, the same things, you know, you use to run your microwave oven on. And they are able to do kind of a 3D MRI-like picture of the inside of a hurricane.
And that microwave data helps a lot. And so does information from the hurricane hunter planes that fly through the storms, getting Doppler radar images, and also drop sensors down through the storm to the ocean surface.
Wow. Okay, so all of this has added a ton of new useful information, I imagine.
Yeah, and it all adds up to big forecasting gains. By last year, a 5-day-out forecast of both track and intensity was about equivalent to a 2-day forecast in 2005.
Oh my God, that's a big jump. Okay, well, what about climate change? Because I'm sure that has had an impact on hurricanes, right?
Absolutely. And not only now do we have 20 more years of observations to understand it, but the theory is also way farther along. Here's Vecchi again.
So it's unambiguous that over the last 40 years, say since the 1980s, hurricanes in the Atlantic have become more frequent, more intense, wetter.
Overall, scientists say climate change kind of puts storms on steroids. And a hotter planet and especially a hotter ocean means storms can penetrate farther north, too. And they're filled with a lot more water, which actually is what does most of the damage. Last year, for example, Hurricane Helene dropped an extra 10% more water than it would have otherwise.
Jeez. So can we expect hurricane forecasts to get even better in the future?
So the Trump administration has slashed funding for many of the organizations critical to hurricane science. Mm-hmm. And so there's now some concern about even keeping up with the progress that already has been made. Kim Wood puts it this way. They're a hurricane scientist at the University of Arizona.
We didn't get this far by saying, yep, we figured out hurricanes, we're done. We have to continue investing in the observations, in the analysis of those observations.
Because that progress has real value. A study from the National Bureau of Economic Research last year found that improvements of forecasts saved the country $2 billion per hurricane because people could better prepare for them. That's more than the budget of the whole Weather Service.
Wow. That is NPR's Alejandra Barunda. Thank you so much, Alejandra.
Yeah, glad to talk.
When someone loses an arm, They can see it's gone, but a new study finds their brain keeps on trying to interact with the missing limb. NPR's John Hamilton reports on a study that challenges some beliefs about the brain's ability to adapt.
A rare circulatory problem cost Emily Weldon her left arm. That was 3 years ago. Weldon says her brain still doesn't know the limb is gone.
Most days it just feels like I've got my arm next to me.
At first, she says, that was a problem.
I had a couple of falls because I was off balance, and then I was trying to put my arm out to stop myself from falling without realizing that it wasn't there.
She's learned not to do that, but Weldon says she still feels the fingers on her missing hand, and she experiences something called phantom limb pain.
It's like throbbing pain that becomes quite unbearable at times.
Now scientists are studying people like Weldon to understand the phantom limb phenomenon. She was one of three people who signed up for a study at University College London after learning they needed to have an arm amputated. Researchers wanted to see how losing a limb might alter the brain. Weldon had a series of brain scans, both before and after her surgery. A scientist named Hunter Schoen was in charge.
And whilst I was in the MRI machine, he'd make me move my fingers on my right hand and then imagine moving my fingers on my left hand.
Weldon also had to purse her lips and move her toes. Schoen, who is now at the University of Pittsburgh, says that allowed the team to study an area of the brain that creates a detailed map of the body.
So when you touch something with your hand, a certain region's activated. If you feel something with your toes, a different region is activated.
And for 50 years or so, many scientists believe the map changed dramatically after an amputation. This allowed brain cells that once interacted with the missing limb to take on other tasks. But Schoen says that's not what his team found when it looked at brain maps for, say, a missing hand.
On every measure we could think of, we see no evidence that the phantom hand representation has changed.
Even years later, earlier studies had found indirect evidence that brain cells once devoted to a hand would begin focusing on the lips, which are right next to the hand on the brain's body map. Schoen says, again, that's not what the team found.
There's no evidence that the map of the lips is changing, which goes completely against all of those old studies that suggest if you lose this body part, this region of the brain is going to completely reorganize.
Schoen says earlier studies were limited because they compared the brains of people who'd lost a limb with the brains of typical people. The new study looked at the same person's brain before and after an amputation.
We all like the idea of our brain being capable of dramatic reorganization. But the idea that we can get neurons to completely change what they've done for their entire lives is a myth, in my opinion.
The study appears in the journal Nature Neuroscience, and Dr. Krish Satyan, chair of neurology at Penn State Health, says it makes a strong case for rethinking how amputation alters the brain.
The plot thickens, which is always the case in science and makes it fun.
But Satyan says he's not sure the new study negates earlier research that found evidence of brain reorganization. One possibility, he says, is that brain cells are like the workers in an office.
They might be specialized and do one particular function really, really well, but they would also do a few other tasks moderately well.
So a brain cell that was really good at processing information from a finger might also be able to process some information from the lips if it needed to. Regardless, Satyan says, the finding that critical brain circuits remain after an amputation is good news for patients.
I think this gives us hope that we can design new treatments.
For example, a prosthetic arm connected to the same brain map once used for a natural arm. John Hamilton, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE, People Power Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is North Star Stories. Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, offering technology for businesses like smart biz, managed voice and Wi-Fi services, security cameras, and more. Online at paulbunyan.net. Paul Bunyan Communications. It's right here. On the River is our volunteer-hosted mix of folk, rock, jazz, blues, and world music on KAXE 7 days a week. Trained community members choose the music every weekday at 1 and 7, plus Saturdays at 4 and Sundays at 1. Big thanks to our dedicated volunteers. Support for KAXE comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. Now for North Star Stories.
This is North Star Stories, voices from where we live. Today in Minnesota,
thousands of Minnesotans could lose health care coverage. Then, Minnesota Special Rescue Team helps out in another state for the first time. And a new opportunity for Native American artists. I'm Chantel Sings. Nearly 140,000 Minnesotans are likely going to lose health care coverage. That's according to a preliminary analysis by the Minnesota Department of Human Services based on Congressional Budget Office data. The department says President Trump's budget reconciliation bill that Congress recently passed will hit low-income adults without children the hardest. The legislation also blocks Medicaid coverage for certain immigrants, including refugees, trafficking victims, and people granted protection under the Convention Against Torture. Ahead, when disaster strikes, a specialized rescue team from Minnesota is dispatched to help survivors. Catherine DeSalle has more on their most recent rescue mission, which sent them to Texas.
A 5-person team made up of Minnesota police, firefighters, and paramedics have returned from a 2-week deployment in Texas. Their mission? Search for Texas flood victims.
We were there for the purpose of helping to get the families have some closure. We were definitely there for the recovery phase of the operation.
That's Brian Plants, the search manager with Minnesota Task Force One, which is one of the state's emergency response teams and managed by the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. The team, plus 2 canine cadaver dogs, searched for flood victims after extreme rainfall in central Texas caused the Guadalupe River to rise over 25 feet, leaving behind destruction and hundreds of missing people.
The conditions in Texas were unlike anything I expected. The scale and the scope of the river there and how much it flooded and the piles of debris that it left behind. Some of the piles were 30 by 30 feet and 10 to 12 feet deep of debris that someone could have been trapped in.
Brian says searching more than 100 miles on foot in the Texas heat was a real challenge.
Really making sure that we stayed cool. It feels like heat of about 104. Also keeping an eye on the canines. They are very driven dogs and they work really, really hard. We had to make sure that they didn't become overheated.
Despite the uncomfortable working conditions, Minnesota's Task Force One's mission to help recover flood victims was a success.
When we first got boots on the ground, we were looking for 100 people that hadn't been accounted for. So between the continued recoveries down there and people they were locating, that number dropped down to 3.
There are 220 members of Minnesota's Task Force One. Most members are full-time firefighters, police officers, or paramedics who applied to be a part of the task force. Members must go through rigorous training in a variety of disciplines to be on the team.
We do rope rescues, trench rescue, confined space rescue, structure collapses, and each one of those is 50 to 80 hours of hands-on and classroom work. Once you pass all those classes, you become eligible to be rostered on the task force and can be on call to respond to any kind of incident that would happen in the real world.
The team has previously responded to Minnesota's 35W bridge collapse, the Minnehaha Academy explosion, and other rescue efforts in the state. The Texas deployment was Task Force One's first extended mission outside of Minnesota.
Part of my task going forward from leading this mission down there will be to train other people on the task force so that we'll be better prepared to go out the door next time.
For North Star Stories, I'm Catherine DeSalle.
You are listening to North Star Stories. The Minnesota Historical Society is searching for Native American artists for its Artists in Residence program. The artists selected for the 6 to 12 month program will receive financial support, access to the Historical Society's collections, and support to visit regional museums, peer artists, and elders. The program is open to all forms of cultural art, including bow and canoe making. Special consideration will be given to traditional media that is seen as endangered, such as pottery and birch bark biting. Artists can apply until October 3rd. Application information is available on the Minnesota Historical Society's website.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the State of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Who wants to be a billionaire? If you ask hit singer-songwriter Kathleen Edwards, she'd raise a hand, but it's probably not the kind of billionaire you're thinking of.
If this feeling were a currency, I would be a billionaire.
That's the title track of her new album, the first from Edwards in 5 years, and her second since she walked away from a grueling schedule of touring and recording and left the industry for a while. She told NPR back in 2020,
I think I just felt a huge sense of relief when I said, I'm done, and I'm done with music.
But now, after rediscovering the joy and the vulnerability in performing, she's back on tour, and she has collaborated with other celebrated names in Americana music along the way. Well, I asked Kathleen Edwards about this moment in her career, starting with an explanation of that title track.
One of my worst traits is that I sometimes like to poke the bear a little bit, and by calling it billionaire, I'm kind of highlighting an interesting social moment where the word is considered to be, like, the only people who are billionaires are people who have too much in this world. And I would argue that we should all aspire to be billionaires. And the song is actually about somebody that I lost who was very dear to me, who was very young when she passed away and still had her whole life ahead of her.
Grief is love, that makes sense, except for the
And I think the song is kind of about the idea that, you know, life is meant to be lived to its fullest and without apology. And if all of your life's adventures enrich your life to become a billionaire in experience, then that's what you should be, if that's what you want.
I want to ask about another song on the album, Little Pink Door, which I read y'all did one take and that was it. You walked away. Is that right?
Well, you know, in the studio, a lot of times you'll do one take and then you'll add overdubs or you'll redo a vocal or add drums. This was everyone played live off the floor, and Wow. It's Jason playing live and Jen Gunderman playing live on keyboard.
Jason Isbell, for people taking note. Yeah, the Jason Isbell. Go on.
The Jason Isbell, the great Jason Isbell. And yeah, it was one live off the floor pass, the three of us, start to finish.
Wow, let's hear a little bit.
I see you later and I thought for sure.
Gotta ask, is there a real little pink door? Is this a real place?
There is a little pink door. There's a place in St. Petersburg, Florida that I pass almost every morning on my little adventure to walk my dogs. And it's just this house that it's sort of, you know, when you pass a beautiful little quaint home that you just think is charming to look at and it captures your imagination and you wonder who lives there and how lucky they are.
Yeah, and like I could live there, and then what would my life be if that were my front door?
You got it. And I kind of touched on an old love story that inspired it, but the house is in St. Petersburg, Florida. It's not mine, but I look forward to handing a copy of my new record off to whoever the owners are who live there.
It's not yours yet. Owners of Little Pink Door House, you've been warned. I was looking back at the last time we spoke with you, and you talked about how you out and out quit the music business at one point. You opened a cafe outside Ottawa, and you named it Quitters, which I love. I just love that because everyone is so anti-quitting. It's all, oh, you can't quit now, keep going, can't quit. And I love that you were like, oh yeah, buddy, try me.
I sold the cafe in early 2022.
Okay.
I opened it in the fall of 2014 on a shoestring budget in a building that needed a ton of work. And I kind of you know, imagined after touring the world and loving coffee shops and them being a real staple in a touring musician's life or in, you know, many people's lives, this place that always made me feel like I had one little tether every day that was, you know, in a bit of a constant. And I thought, well, if I'm going to not do music, I better find something else to do. And sure enough, I did.
Well, as you and I are speaking right now, Kathleen Edwards, you've been touring all this summer. We're talking to you because you've got this new album coming out. You have most definitely unquit. I wonder, is there a song on here that speaks to that momentum in your life?
Oh, gosh. You know, Say Goodbye, Tell No One was a little bit of a kiss off song from the coffee shop.
People change, people grow. You can take it in stride or slam a door.
One of the things that owning my own business I had to learn, which I'm slightly embarrassed, but also proud to say it, I had to put my big girl pants on. When my first record came out, I was 22. I had a manager and an agent, and I'd sort of been scooped out of Ottawa and thrust onto the David Letterman show the day my record came out.
Wow. Yeah.
And so for years, I had this incredible group of people supporting me, but they were the ones having difficult conversations on my behalf. And one of the things that I realized coming through being a small business owner is you have to confront hard truths, whether they're about you or the people that work for you or the fact that your business has to close, all those things. And I think the joy of playing music is such a renewed gift to me. But also, I'm no longer nervous about what people are going to think of me. And just because you have to tell somebody something that's really hard and might hurt their feelings doesn't mean that you're a bad person. And I think that's what sometimes the record is about.
I love that. Well, that, I guess, brings us full circle. I was going to ask you what counts as success to you at this point, at this moment. And it sounds like it circles back to the billionaire idea and what really matters.
It is. That's all that life is about. And I think the song that called Billionaire that I wrote for my beautiful friend, Amanda, she was the most living and optimistic person. She came into the coffee shop as a customer and she ended up running the place. And losing her reminded me that that life is really just about having great people in your life and wanting to tell them that they're a gift to you.
Well, amen to all of that. Kathleen Edwards, thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate so much you being interested in talking to me. I'm humbled. I'm really humbled.
We've been talking about her new album, her first album in 5 years. It is titled Billionaire.
You're listening to All Things Considered. Support for NPR comes from this station. And from BritBox, presenting Outrageous, a new BritBox original drama based on the scandalous true story of England's infamous Mitford sisters. Streaming this and more original series at BritBox.com. From Easy Cater, a business tool for food, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at EasyCater.com. From Workday, an AI platform to manage HR, finance, and agents that aims to free business leaders from the mundane so they can focus on more meaningful work. Workday, moving business forever forward. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at kaxe.org. We receive support from Headwaters Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Bemidji. Huff's congregation strives to build bridges with the community and welcomes all to seek truth, practice love, and celebrate life. Learn more at headwatersuu.org. After Dark is KAXE's Saturday night program after Green Cheese from 9 to midnight, featuring styles of music like punk, metal, R&B, hip-hop, and more. This week's host, Zima Queen, will be playing ambient electronica. Interested in